All right, well, I'll say Shabbat Shalom. We have Passover and the days of unleavened bread now behind us. Welcome, young man. So we're going to press on today with our series where we're attempting, of course, to cover the words of Yehovah in the First Testament. I suspect our next pause on this will be sometime prior to Pentecost, unless, of course, the Holy Spirit directs otherwise. We left off, if you'll recall, at the end of Exodus chapter 4. Moses, of course, having received instruction from the Lord, he shared that information with Aaron. Both of them were, of course, traveling to Egypt, meeting with the elders of the children of Israel. They had relayed to the children of Israel what God had spoken and promised them. And we understand from the text that they were happy, very happy to hear the news that God was going to release them from their slavery. So as we move to chapter 5, we find Moses and Aaron coming before Pharaoh of Egypt and telling them what the Lord had said. He was not as overjoyed. Exodus 5, verse 1. Afterwards, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness." And Pharaoh said, "Who is this Lord? Who is this God of yours that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I don't know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go." So there you have it. That sets up then this whole situation that then transpires from chapter 5 all the way through the end of chapter 11. For perspective's sake, chapter 12 begins the instructions to Israel for Passover, of course, to avoid the final plague of the death of the firstborn. So from chapter 5 through 11, we have seven complete chapters. We have the story of the 10 plagues that was put upon Egypt, ultimately, of course, to cause Pharaoh to finally let the Israelites leave. Now, you know, I looked at this, and we could look at each time, you know, through those chapters of every time that Yehovah speaks. We could analyze that and use that as a framework here. But really, when you look at that, he really is just saying the same thing, isn't he, over and over to Pharaoh. And what he's saying to Pharaoh is the same thing we've already covered. It's the same thing he told Moses to tell Pharaoh, right? So we've already covered that. So he has spoken his will here, and we've covered that. In these seven chapters then, he executes then what he has spoken. He said he was going to deliver them. He's already said that. Now we get to see how he delivered them. And truly, there's more, I believe, revealed in the doing than in the speaking. Because God spoke it, the reality of it was sure, wasn't it? The moment that he spoke it, that became real. But then it unfolded. Right? And as it unfolds, it reveals even more than what he actually spoke. And we see that in most all prophecy, don't we? We see Yehovah, that he reveals things, but then when it comes to pass, we have the benefit of being on the backside of the spring holy days. And so as some of those things were said to them. But now after it's been done and executed, it reveals so much more than what he actually even spoke. And, you know, we think about that, and men are usually exact opposite. We tend to use more words and less action. But that's not the case. And, you know, when Yehovah reveals something and it comes to pass, it's just so much more. And we're going to see that as we go forward towards the end of this age. But it's very true as well in this situation here. You know, you can take a casual reading of those chapters, the story of the 10 plagues, and you can come away from that with a very decent narrative of a solid lesson that's conveyed there. You know, God's in charge. He said he'd deliver them. He did deliver them. He demonstrated his power, and he ultimately brings them out of Egypt just as he said he would. It's great. Pharaoh's defeated. Yehovah reveals himself again as the true God to Israel and chooses them as his nation. He's faithful. He can be taken at his word. Children can read that story and come away inspired and in awe of the great God, Yehovah, right? But we know that God's multifaceted. It's never just that simple. There's always more. Because Yehovah connects everything, you know, he really does. We continually find these intricate patterns occurring over and over with him. God is a God of order and depth that is amazing to me. Everything he does is amazing. Everything he does is interconnected. You know, the Bible says that everything is established on two or three witnesses. Well, God provides those witnesses, boom, 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 himself. You know, just witness after witness where everything just ties back to each other. The Bible is amazing in the fact that it says the same thing over and over again. It just in different ways. The depth and levels of connectedness is really extraordinary. And the events surrounding these 10 plagues isn't any different. Any different at all. You know, think about it. Yehovah said, I'm gonna choose these people and I'm gonna get them out of Egypt. How many ways could he have done that? You ever think about that? He could have told Moses, hey Moses, go in there, tell the Israelites, go into their houses, because I'm gonna rain fire and brimstone down, and boop boop, it's done in 10 minutes. Just like he did Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, he put judgment on them. Bam! They're gone. He could have done the same thing with Egypt. He didn't do that, did he? So there's got to be something there. There has to be a... God doesn't never do anything without a reason. So we have to ask, you know, why 10 plagues? Why 10? Why not 2? No, it's 6 or 12. Why 10? Why plagues at all? Why do it that way? There's nothing out of the reach of Yehovah to execute what he spoke to deliver them from Egypt. Could have done it any way he wanted. So why did he do it this way? Well, some would say to show his power, right? But, you know, Yehovah is not some insecure being that needs to show off to show his power, right? So everything he does is for a reason, and that isn't one of them. Some might say it was to humble the Egyptians or to teach them a lesson. Okay, but when we jump to the very end of the story, where are the Egyptians? They're wiped out. So again, if that was his ultimate goal, he could have done that in minutes, instantly, if he wanted to. So I submit to you that we should be looking at this not at what he was teaching the Egyptians, but what he was teaching the Israelites by how he was dealing with the Egyptians. Because the whole process for them did, you know, it didn't, when they were given Passover and said to leave, that whole process started for the Israelites as soon as Moses stepped foot in the area and had a download with the elders. That's when this whole process of education and everything started for them, because the whole thing left the Egyptians wiped out. The lessons, at least in this age, were not for them. It was for the Israelites, and by extension, us. So rather than looking at this as punishments for Egypt, which it was, I think we gain a lot more insight if we look at them as lessons for us. There are layers of connections here that go far beyond the casual childhood reading of simply God showing that he had power over them and that he released Israel from slavery. For sure, he's revealing himself as the true God to Egypt, because we see that clearly in Exodus 7. It says, Pharaoh will not heed you. This is Yehovah speaking, telling Moses that Pharaoh will not heed you, so that I may lay my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring the children of Israel from among them. So that was the purpose, right? But realize that the Israelites were seeing all of this too. And again, the Egyptians end up dead. So the lesson for them was lost. So the Israelites are the ones that went forward with this lesson, firmly planted in their minds. Yehovah knows what he's doing. It's stated later in Exodus 14. This is after it's all right done, okay? Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt, and so the people feared the Lord. They had respect for the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. So we have to understand that was Yehovah's ultimate goal, to reveal himself to Israel so that they would revere him, see him as God, fear him, and erase the influence of the false gods of Egypt. And this is why Yehovah did the plagues that he did, to destroy the gods of Egypt in the hearts of his people. He didn't pick these randomly. Each one of these whittled away at the false gods that Egypt worshipped. And Israel needed to see this. They needed this, right? They needed to understand that they were false gods. And this is supported by Numbers 33, where we read, "For the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had killed among them. Also on their gods the Lord had executed judgments." So the connections to the false gods, to the plagues, were not lost on the Israelites either. It's why, at the end of this, they were more than willing to wipe the blood on the lintels and everything, where probably many of them had carved false gods, as we talked about, on there. They were willing to do that. They had seen it. It was demonstrated to them that they were false. So I want to take just a minute, because I know not all of you, but most of you have probably seen these connections before. So I'm gonna cruise through them pretty quickly, and then we're gonna continue to make some other connections that maybe may or may not have considered before. The first off, plague number one, of course, was turning the Nile to blood. And this god, Hapi, was the supposed god of the Nile that was to bring water. She was the water bearer. And they recognized water, of course, is necessary for life. And so he was worshipped for bringing life-giving water. You'll see another fascinating connection to this later. Osiris could also be mentioned here, as it was said that it was her blood in the form of water that flowed through the Nile, you know. But what we find is there was 7 days, right, where the water was turned into blood, and it remained that way for that period of time. The perfect length of time, seven. Perfect length of time to demonstrate that the Lord was completely superior to all the other gods of Egypt. They knew that life was sustained by water, so they worshiped this god. But Yehovah is the true giver of life. And what are we told? The life is in the blood. Isn't that interesting? That this is the first one. You know, Yehovah is the life giver, and the life is in the blood. And he's just undoing everything here. I mean, both physically and spiritually, from the blood of Yeshua, we get life eternal, which is the true essence of what's going. See, you know, he just weaves. I could go on, and I can't do it. I don't have time. But Yehovah just weaves everything like a wonderful tapestry. Okay, plague two also came from the river as a massive swarm of frogs. And here we have this Heket. And it's a god with a frog head. You can't make this stuff up. Also associated with water, she's a goddess that was to bring fertility and renewal from the water. But in this plague, what was coming from the water was disgusting. It was nothing like renewal. The exact opposite was happening. No renewal at all. Nothing good was coming from the Nile. Just disgusting frogs, and lots of them. They were in their houses, in their beds, in their clothing, in their food. They were everywhere. Now, the magicians were able to create the illusion of bringing more of them out of the Nile, but it was only the true God that was able to make them go away, right? And so what's that show? Who had ultimate control then over the renewal from the Nile, right? The third plague of lice, I think is interesting as well, because Yehovah could have brought those lice anywhere. He could have just done a number of things. We're going to touch on that a little bit later. But what he did was he had Aaron strike the dust of the earth. And here we have Geb, who is the ruler of the dust of the earth, supposedly. And so when Aaron touched the ground, lice came forth. Okay? Now, the magicians tried this, and they couldn't do it. And so it was at this point then that the magician said, "Huh, I give up. This is the finger of God," right? And what we find is from this point forward, Yehovah would not use Aaron's rod anymore. He actually used, we're going to cover that in a few minutes, but he used Aaron's rod on the first three. Okay. But he didn't do that. And there's a pattern kind of that emerges out of this. And because only certain plagues, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but only certain plagues were announced where Pharaoh got a warning. Okay? Some of them he got a warning, some of them he didn't. And there's a pattern to it. I made this little chart to help you kind of visualize it. The first thing is to divide the first nine plagues into these three groups. One row I did for kind of each group here, okay? And when you look at this, sequentially, in the first two of each group, Pharaoh is warned. He said, well, if you don't let the Israelites go, you know, this is what's going to happen. And then the plague comes. But in the third one of each group, there was no warning at all. None. So the first three plagues are brought on by Aaron. That's who God used to kind of execute them. He holds his staff out as the instrument of it. And so in Exodus 7:19 and Exodus 8:6, that he had warning. But in Exodus 8:16, he did not give a warning. It's the same with the next three, okay? Exodus 8:20 and Exodus 9:6, it was God who made the statement, you know, of course, through Moses, to Pharaoh. And he got warning in those two. But in Exodus 9:10, no warning. The same with the last three. And here, you know, God instructed Moses to use his staff. Okay, same thing, Exodus 9:22 and Exodus 10:12, he gets a warning. In Exodus 10:21, he doesn't. I don't know. You know, but I'm just sharing this because I think this stuff is fascinating. When I look at this, it just makes me just in awe more of God as a God of order and structure and cycles. And that's how he created this universe. It's how he organizes it. I mean, that sun comes up every day, you know, and he's faithful in everything. Everything is ordered, right? And I don't know, I just thought I'd share this with you because I thought it was cool. And I believe firmly that there is probably a really interesting connection here. I'm not smart enough to know what it is. Maybe some yet. Maybe Yehovah will reveal it to one of us if we pray about it and study on it. But there's something there, because there always is. And that's what I want. I thought, well, do I share this or not? Because I don't know what it means. I'm like, well, why not? Why not? All right, let's learn together. Anyway, the next plague was the flies. And this Egyptian god literally had the head of a fly. It's amazing. I won't even try to pronounce the name. But it's interesting when you read about this false god being the one that rules the movement of the sun. They talk about rebirth because that's the cycle of the sun coming up every morning. And it's a separation, isn't it, of the day to the night. And that's what this god was supposedly all about. And that's interesting. Why? Because this was the first plague that began the separation of the plagues from the Israelites. The flies only affected the Egyptians. The Israelites were unaffected. See, Yehovah is the true God of everything. He alone separates the night from the day. That's probably Leah. He alone separates the night from the day. You know, the sheep from the goats, the wheat from the chaff, all of those things. And what are those things? What is separation tied to? Judgment. If you're going to separate, you have to make judgments as you're doing it.
They need it on Google Meet.
No, they don't. They need to be on stream because they're still thinking that it's 2 o'clock like everybody else today. What was I saying? Oh, separation, day from night, you know, all that is nothing more than judgment, right? So one has to judge in order to separate, and so Yehovah began revealing right here with this one at the same time of these flies with this God, supposedly, that he's the ultimate judge. He's the one that separates light from darkness. He's the judge. And he's saying, I'm not judging Israel, Pharaoh. This is coming on you and you alone. It's coming on to Egypt. And it becomes clear that it's Egypt that is being judged and Israel is being protected. And it started right here with the plague of flies. And it continues the rest of the way through the plagues. The next plague, the plague of pestilence on the livestock, only affected the Egyptians. And it's not surprising. Hathor is depicted with the head of a cow. Apsis as a bull. Were these gods able to protect the Egyptians from the pestilence that hit their livestock? The god of cow and the god of bull? No! You know, and this virtually wiped out all of their livestock. And it didn't touch the livestock of the Israelites. So, do they have power? Of course not. And I guarantee you this fact was not lost on the Israelites. They are systematically, during this process, learning that the gods of Egypt are nothing. But the God of their fathers, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, are in full control. The next plague was on the flesh of the Egyptians themselves, boils. But Isis, their god of medicine, health, and peace, was again powerless to help them. Yet again, the true God of Israel was able to protect the Israelites from the very same condition. No boils came upon them, completely demonstrating who the true God was from the false, who was being judged and who was not. Next, we have a plague of hail. And this nut, literally her name, as the Egyptian goddess of the sky, wasn't much help to the Egyptians either. Once again, the true God kept the hail only on the Egyptian territory and not on the land of the Israelites. And we're going to see in a little bit how strong that storm was, and yet it was a line. Amazing, right? We're gonna look at a couple more connections on this in a little bit. But for now, the next one was locusts. And this was another plague that came from the sky. And when you study this, there's obviously some overlap in many of these, and we see that here. The locusts came from the sky, but the chaos and the damage that they caused was devastating. But Seth couldn't help them, obviously, because he's not real. The Egyptians... food supply during this was completely and totally wiped out, as was any reality that might be in the minds of the Israelites as to the power of these gods. This Min guy was likely blamed as well. Exodus 9, I think it's verse 31. It says that the plagues, these last two plagues, came when the flax and the barley were about to be harvested, but this was before the wheat, right? So at this very time, the Egyptians had this celebration, one of their feast days, called the Coming Out of Min. And it was celebrated in Egypt at the beginning of that harvest. And these plagues wiped that out. So men's little coming out party was canceled that year. The ninth plague, of course, was darkness. And that corresponds with, of course, Ra, the sun god. So you got a sun god and the sun goes dark. Where's Ra? Where is he? Where's the light of their God? Nowhere to be found. When the true God decides there will be no sun, there will be no sun. And the sun, other than Pharaoh himself, actually connected to Pharaoh himself, was the most worshipped God in Egypt. And so this was like a kind of a crowning major point. You know, the sun god is no more. It went dark, okay, for 3 solid days. 3 days. Why 3 days? I need to make that connection for you. Was there ever a time when the true light of the world was snuffed out for 3 days? Connections abound, folks. The Lord showed that he had control over the sun as a witness that the God of Israel had ultimate power over life and death. You know, I think about, you know, this crowning thing, the psychological and spiritual impact that this would have had on Egypt had to have been profound, because this was the most prevalent God. All the other gods were subservient to him. And darkness in their religion was representative of death, of judgment, and hopelessness. I mean, this had an impact. And yet, at the same time, we read that Israel had light in their dwellings. So here again, the separation continues. Who's being judged? Egypt is dark, light in Israel. It's amazing. So they had to think, well, who's the God of light now, right? The last plague, of course, is the death of the firstborn, and was a direct affront to Pharaoh himself. Why? Because Pharaoh held himself up as literal God. He declared himself as the son of Ra, the son of Ra in the flesh. And it's really interesting. There's some Egyptian religious texts that talk about this plague, the 10th plague. There's a remarkable, it's called the Cannibal Hymn, and it's carved into an old kingdom pyramid at Unas, U-N-A-S. And it states this. Check this out. "It is the king who will be judged with him whose name is hidden on that day of slaying the firstborn." A variation of this appears in a coffin text from a royal pyramid inscription, and it reads pretty similar. "I am he who will be judged with him whose name is hidden on that night of slaying the firstborn." So this is just more historical, archaeological evidence of these events. The slaying of the firstborn by the judge whose name is hidden, Yehovah, was not something that was easily forgotten by the Egyptians. And it was recorded by some of the surviving Egyptians, apparently. By killing Pharaoh's firstborn, the idea that Pharaoh was a god was completely shot down to anybody with eyes to see. I mean, how could that happen? How could this powerful god, the son of Ra, allow his son to be killed? Okay, but you have to have eyes to see, don't you? And so never for, you know, guys, we always have to be so appreciative of the marvelous blessing of sight to be able to see these connections right in front of us and revealing the true God. Because Satan has used some people, unwittingly, they don't know it, to try and obscure these connections by offering up purely naturalistic explanations for the plagues. That's not surprising. I mean, we see that it's still going on today, isn't it? Right? Our world is obviously created. It can't not be created. When there is a design, there's a designer. There's intelligence that had to come from outside of the creation. Okay, and it's obvious. But what do we have? We still have Satan inspiring people to find a natural explanation, reverting to chance over billions of years. But you know, Yehovah is brilliant in the way that he does things. He does enough to show himself, but sometimes does it in ways that he uses the laws that he created, right, to do certain things. But he only takes that so far. So if you have eyes to see, you see past that. If you don't, you're stuck in the muck of lies. And we see that in the plagues. In several of the first plagues, Pharaoh's magicians were supposedly able to reproduce at least an illusion of duplicating them. You know, although not to the level that, of course, Jehovah did them. And this was allowed so that Pharaoh's heart remained hardened. We see this in the first plague when the river was turned to blood. In Exodus 7, it says, "The magicians of Egypt did so with their enchantments, and Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, as the Lord had said. And Pharaoh turned and went into his house, and neither was his heart moved by this." So they were able to do it just enough that he had an excuse, right? The magicians brought frogs from the river in plague number 2. "And the magicians did so with their enchantments and brought up frogs in the land of Egypt." It only took to the third plague, like we already talked about with the lice, for the magicians to hold up their hands and say, "I give," you know, and that's when, of course, God told Moses to have Aaron strike the earth with his rod for lice to come forth. And we read this in Exodus 8. "And they did so. For Aaron stretched out his hand with his rod and struck the dust of the earth, and it became lice on man and beast. All the dust of the land became lice throughout all the land of Egypt." All the dust of the land became lice. Can you imagine? And now the magicians so worked with their enchantments to bring forth lice, but they could not. So there were lice on man and beast. Then the magician said to Pharaoh, "This is the finger of God." But still in the face of that, Pharaoh's heart grew hard and he did not heed them, just as the Lord had said. And we find this, don't we? This connection to our society. Many hearts are still hard today, still trying to find ways to duplicate the plagues without there actually being a God. And they do this because one of their sciences is archaeology. And archaeology, as we just saw, you know, continues to give credence to these plagues. So they have to, because their science also says they happened, right? They have to figure out how they happened without a creator God. And we find these ancient artifacts that substantiate the biblical narrative. I'm going to share just two. First is an ancient text called the Admonitions of Ipuwer. And it's where the author is describing a certain event in Egypt. Why, really, the river Nile is blood. If one drinks of it, one rejects it as human and thirsts for water. Well, it doesn't take much connection to figure out what he's talking about. Here's another one, the prophecy of Nepharohu. It relates to the ninth plague. The sun disk is covered over. It will not shine so that people may see. No one knows when midday falls, for his shadow cannot be distinguished. So these types of things cause these scholars to have to deal with the historical reality of these plagues. And so they revert to their natural causes. The most sophisticated attempt at this to relate to natural phenomena uses the Egyptian ecosystem. And according to this interpretation, the first six plagues can be explained in their sequential order. The count is connected initially to violent rainstorms that happen in the mountains of Ethiopia. The first plague, then, blood, is the red clay, supposedly, that, you know, from these torrential rains, red clay comes down into the Nile, turns the Nile red. So just like the magicians, there's a certain correlation here. The magicians did their little illusion to try to show that they made blood, and now our magicians, called scientists, are trying to say that, well, we can turn the Nile red too with just a big rainstorm, okay? But I choose to believe the actual text. I choose to believe what God said. He turned it to blood. He didn't turn it red, turned it to blood. The Egyptians might have turned it red, but he turned it to blood. And there's a difference between blood and just red food coloring or red clay. And we're going to make another connection to that later. But for now, according to this naturalist struggling to get rid of a creator, the mud choked the fish. The fish clogged the swamps where the frogs lived. So the fish were infected with anthrax. How they know that, I don't know. But this caused the frogs, which was the second plague, to leave the Nile for the coolness of the houses and the clothes and the food and all that, because, you know, they come out of the water, you know, we got to go where it's cool. Okay. So because then the frogs were infected with anthrax, they died in the houses. Conveniently, all of them on the same day, at the same time that God said it was going to happen. Anyway, so now the frogs are dead and they pile them all up and they're rotting. As a consequence, lice, the third plague, and flies, the fourth plague, began to multiply, right? Feeding off of the dead frogs. So now we have this instantaneous mass multiplication. Okay, we're supposed to believe that. Now this gave rise, of course, to the pestilence that attacked the animals, because obviously, you know, the anthrax got on the grass, and the animals ate the grass, and it made them sick, And there you have it. So then the man also gets the anthrax from the animals and the grass, and he breaks out with boils, which is, of course, the sixth plague. Now, if you're tracking all that happened because of a rainstorm. A massive rainstorm. Never mind some other huge holes in all this that if you look at the details of the text, you'll see it. I'm not going to give this foolishness the benefit of taking valuable time here for a real close examination. But in trying to explain the next four, well, they need a new event because that one's not tracking, okay? So they say that this is related to other atmospheric and climatic conditions in Egypt that created the hailstorms, the seventh plague. And that came out of nowhere, although it's very uncommon. It does happen. You can have hail in Egypt. Now, I would question, if you look at the narrative, it says that this hail was bringing trees down. Trees. How big does hail have to be to bring trees down? And, you know, when you try to be a pilot, you go through all that training, you study a lot about things like that. And when hail forms and how it forms and when it falls, it's melting because it's coming at, you know, 120 miles an hour and it gets hot and it melts. There's a lot that, I don't know how you get hail big enough to fell trees. And have that hail big enough to fell trees in Egypt, but not a drop of it occurs over in Israel. Okay? But I don't know. Science, I don't think science could explain that. But anyway, in the continued logic, the hailstorm is followed by the eighth plague, locusts, which is a common natural phenomenon that can happen. The ninth plague, darkness, they say, was probably nothing more than a Libyan dust storm. And I sat and I thought about that, and I was like, you got to be kidding me. So the first six plagues happened because we had such a massive rainstorm, massive, like flood type, you know, biblical proportion rainstorm that washes all this clay down in the Nile River. But then just a little bit later, everything's so dried up, we can have a dust storm. I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. And the naturalistic scholars have another huge problem with number 10, okay? For this, they cite that they have information relating to the high infant mortality rate in Egypt. What they don't realize is that it didn't matter if they were infants or not. Every age of every animal and every human being in Egypt was killed. So that didn't work either. So there's a lot of broken links in this ecological chain that they cite. For instance, there's no causality between the plague of boils, the sixth plague, and the hail. There's no ecological chain there. There's nothing linking those. The ecological chain is broken again between the plagues, the seventh, eighth, and ninth sequence with the hail, the locusts, and the darkness. There's no link between them at all. And there's no link between the ninth darkness and the tenth death of the firstborn. Nevertheless, they continue to pass this off as scientific, in the same way they do evolution, which I also thought was fascinating. Think about that. Okay? Evolution is touted as the answer to creation. And in these plagues, we have God of creation doing these plagues, okay, of God of creation, and they're trying to use science to undo them, to explain them. It's kind of a fascinating parallel because there's some very cool connections between the plagues and creation. How God Why not? Because look, God was doing two things. He was not only putting down the false gods, he was also revealing himself as the true God, which is the God of what? Creation. Okay? He's the God of creation. So he's revealing himself in that. I'm going to show you that. And so here's the God of creation, and we have the same thing going on now. We have God of creation and the scientists using naturalistic things to overcome that. And the same thing happened with these plagues. I mean, have you ever thought why God, why there was 10? I'm going to show you something here. Sure, all 10 can be related to false gods, as we've seen. But every one of them can also be related to some part of creation. When you go to Genesis 1, you will find 10 separate utterances of God that he made in order to create the universe. You know, light and water, earth, vegetation, sun, fish and birds, livestock, man, food for man, herbs for all, for everybody. You can find those things. And each one of these is directly relatable to the plagues in some way. God connects himself during the judgment of Egypt back to his creative work, which in turn reveals the God that he is, the God of creation. He is the creator. Okay, here, Exodus 7:19 says that the Lord spoke to Moses, say to Aaron, take your rod and stretch out your hand over the waters. And this is from the Hebrew mikvah of Egypt, over their streams, over their rivers, their ponds, over all the pools of water, that they may become blood. So this, the first plague is described here, and we're told that Aaron is to take his staff and hold it over all of Egypt's bodies or gatherings of water, and they will become blood. That's the Hebrew word, mikvah. It's the word for bodies or gatherings of water. And it's the same word that appears in the opening chapters of Genesis when God creates the seas, Genesis 1:9. I'm just giving this as one example here. Then God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. So he's speaking these instructions. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters he called seas, mikvah. And God saw that it was good. So the use of the word mikvah in Exodus 7:19 in connection with the plague of blood, I mean, you can't fail to suggest an association with the creation of the seas in Genesis 1:10. In Exodus 7:19, we read that they may become blood. He's speaking that. And we've got a similar expression in Genesis 1:9, let the waters, okay? Yehovah is speaking as creator and controller of his creation. And he's showing his connection back to creation when he organized the waters to begin with. You look at plagues 2, 3, and 4, which were frogs, lice, and flies, right? Well, they're interesting as well. The frogs are associated with water. The lice with the earth. He intentionally told him, touch the earth to do it. The flies with things that fly in the air. Frogs, we are told, came out of the, what did it say? It said the rivers, the canals, and the ponds of Egypt, right? All these things. But in Genesis, God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures. That referred to the plague. What happened to all the fish? They died, okay, in the plague. And Yehovah has power. He's judging, right? He made the creation, and he can judge that same creation. Similarly, with the lice, the third plague, it came forth where? At the dust of the earth. Exodus 8:12, we read that. The lice corresponding to the crawling creatures in Genesis 1:24. The flies, the fourth plague, correspond to the flying creatures. In Genesis 1:22, God orders that flying creatures multiply in the land. That's what he said. He spoke that. He said, this is what will occur. And so when he gives judgment on Egypt, not only are they multiplied in the land, they filled the land. And in Genesis, it was meant as a blessing. In Egypt, it's meant as a judgment. After the fly plague, the situation in Egypt was a complete reversal. It was a judgment on Egypt of one that was anticipated by the divine blessing in mankind in Genesis 1:28, where God said that man was to rule the fish of the sea, the winged creatures of the heavens, and all living creatures which creep on the earth. So what happened then in Egypt? Every single one of those things, okay? The fish of the sea, the winged creatures, and the living creatures which creep on the earth, all of those things were totally out of control. Completely out of control. The fifth plague, pestilence, affected only animals, not men, and only the field animals of the Egyptians and not the Israelites. Okay? Now, in Genesis 2, 18 and 20, the animals are created what? Specifically for man, and man is given dominion over them. And so what then does God do when he judges the Egyptians? He takes that dominion away, right? He takes those animals away from the Egyptians. That which was first created for man was first removed from the Egyptians by that plague. And it was the first plague that was specifically directed towards living created beings, the animals first. The sixth plague, boils, relates to the fact that Yehovah made man initially. When he made him, what did he say? He said it was very good. This is very good, right? Okay. So you go into Leviticus, I don't remember. I think it's Leviticus 12 or 13, right? Where it talks about clean and unclean. What do we find out about boils? You're unclean. So in Genesis, when he makes man, he says in his original state, you're very good. Then he puts boils on the Egyptians and he says, you're not very good. Not now, you're unclean. They were judged from where they were originally created. They were unclean. And this was very poignant to Pharaoh and everybody there because, again, Pharaoh considered himself God. All of his officers were considered priests. They all got the boils. They all were unclean, right? Okay. The next two plagues, hail and locusts, involve other parts of the creation and Yehovah's utterances about vegetation, fruit of the trees, herbs of the field, crops from seed, all of those things that he spoke, right? What wasn't destroyed by the hail was eaten by the locusts. When those two plagues were over and had run their course, Egypt was wiped, it was decimated. And it could be, so you think about that condition and then you contrast that with what God said on the third day of creation, the land brought forth vegetation, bearing seed, bearing seed with fruit and seed in it. And so you just contrast those two things that in Exodus 10 we're told nothing green was left of tree or grass of the field in all of Egypt. So he utters this creation and then he makes this pronouncement on Egypt in these very similar connected ways. Then there's the plague of darkness, of course, the ninth plague. In Exodus 10, 21, 23, we read that a thick darkness descended upon all the land of Egypt for 3 days. Let's read it. The Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven, that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, darkness which may even be felt, So Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was thick darkness in all the land for 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days, but all the children of Israel had light in their dwellings. And what we see here is not just a description of the absence of light. This darkness is something very physical. It's a darkness that can be touched, it says. So the alternation of light and darkness, of day and night, had ceased. Yet darkness and light exist side by side in geographically distinct places because the Israelites had light. In short, in Egypt, God had reverted the relationship between darkness and light to what had been prior to him establishing it in Genesis. Again, connecting himself back to his creative work. And so when we look at the final plague, the death of the firstborn, it's only a forerunner, really, to the complete destruction that happened at the Red Sea, right? In Genesis 1:26, God said, "I will make man in my image after my likeness." Now, when executing judgment on Egypt, instead of creating, what's he doing? He's destroying. First the firstborn and then everybody else at sea, all of Egypt. And so when we look back at this and we think about Egypt or Israel standing on the other side of the Red Sea, looking over that water, they see a land with no people. After all this, there's no people, there's no animals, there's no vegetation. A land in which creation had been undone. Israel is convinced that her Redeemer is the Lord of all creation. He who had just reduced order to chaos was the same one who had previously ordered the chaos. You know? Right? It just seems like every one of those 10 utterances of Yehovah in Genesis is covered in the 10 plagues or judgments of Egypt. 10 representing numerical perfection. 7, of course, represents spiritual perfection. And it's interesting that we have the plagues talked about. There's two other accounts of the plagues in the Bible. One in Psalm 78, the other one in Psalm 105. And those psalms differ in the way that they present the plagues, the order in which they were in. The psalmists are basically talking about the plagues. Okay, we have here, in, you know, a sequential thing of them. And so I take that kind of to indicate that the specific number or order of the plagues wasn't as important to them as the fact that the plagues happened. And I find it very interesting that they each list 7 of them. 7 being the number of spiritual completion or impact, right? And what do we have? We have 7 days of creation. Seven days for a complete creation, 7 plagues for complete destruction, right? And you add to that the fact that the 7th day is the Sabbath. You know, 2 times we're given the Sabbath command in the Bible. And I'll close with this. The first is in Exodus 20, and the reason cited there is this. "For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them, and rested the 7th day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it." Okay, we also have it in Deuteronomy. The reason cited there is this. "Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." So the Sabbath points both to creation, okay, just like the plagues did, and also to judgment, which the plagues did in judging Egypt. God gave us this Sabbath command to remind us that we are created, right? But then we sinned. And we deserve the same destruction and the same plagues that came upon Egypt. But in the grace and the mercy of Passover and all of that, we also get this second Sabbath command to remind us that we are redeemed. We are freed from bondage. Now, I cherish that. We are created and we are recreated. And the Sabbath is expressed to us in a way that reminds us of both things. It's the only one of the Ten Commandments that vary like that. You see, without the second one, if we just had the first one pointing to creation, we'd be done. Why? But why? Because we've all sinned after creation, just like the Egyptians did. We need the outstretched arm of Yehovah to bring us out of slavery just like they did. It's why the Sabbath is a special treasure. It's a weekly reminder of our salvation. It's a picture. Like I say, everything weaves together, but that whole thing that happened is just yet another picture of God, you know, God's hands working through things, just like He worked through those plagues. Now, I'm sure, as I've looked at this, I've just probably scratched the surface. But my hope is that in looking at these plagues in this way, and looking at these connections and evaluating this, that it will awaken you more, or inspire you, or remind you to look deeper into everything you read in God's Word. Because it's the initial message is always sound, but there's always more. There's always a depth. Our God is a master weaver. And He doesn't do anything by accident. And there's nothing there that's inconsequential. And He always interconnects everything He does, adding more and more depth. So let us always stand in awe of His amazing mind and be eternally grateful for His outstretched arm. Amen?
Amen.